Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Right Now Weekly Radio Show, hosted by Vicki Winterton, founder of Expert Insights Publishing, home of best-selling books, award-winning magazines, global broadcasts and communities. Right Now is a highly educational, inspiring, and empowering show focused on writing, publishing, and marketing your books, featuring outstanding guests from across the globe, including best-selling authors, world stage speakers, thought leaders, and visionaries with proven strategies, secret formulas, and treasured resources to help you succeed and make an impact. Welcome, sit back, and enjoy the show. And now your host, Vicki Winterton.
This is Vicki Winterton, and I am so thrilled today because with me I have Ross Wright. Ross is the CEO of his own musical empire as conductor and composer for the award-winning Los Angeles-based Orchestra Surreal. Ross leads one of the most electric, original, and entertaining orchestras on the planet, and he also is an amazing writer with a wonderful new book. So, Ross, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I was wondering, for those that may not be familiar with you or your work, if you could start by sharing with us how you came about this passion for all this creativity in your life. You've done so much with music and now writing. Give us a little background on how that rolled out for you.
Well, I think... For me, I think probably for most people that are, it's just what you do. It's just kind of how it happens. And you don't really think that you're doing anything particularly creative or different. That's just kind of how you're wired. I mean, that's kind of, I think, as a musician, my main thing is I went to school as a musician. I've always, even as a little kid, I was always fascinated by music. And I played, in the fourth grade, my first instrument was the trombone, I played in the band. And then I started playing guitar, I played bass, and I went to music school and learned music theory, and I wrote my first piece for orchestra when I was about 15 or 16, and I remember I was 17 when I wrote a piece for I grew up in Laguna Beach, and it was the Saddleback Community Orchestra. I wrote a piece that they performed.
Wow.
Anyhow, I was 17 then. And so I got my feet wet, and I just kind of did it, it wasn't something you just want to do it, so you do it. And I think one of the good things about being young is you don't know. It helps sort of to not know what you're doing, because you're not judgmental. You're not your own critic, because I think we are often our worst critics. As you get, one of the problems as you get older is you know your stuff sucks, so you edit your, or at least you think it does. Sometimes you surprise yourself. But anyway. So, I just was always working as a musician and doing that, and as a composer, and I've studied, in college, and I got a master's degree in classical music composition, and not that really means much, but it was at least some training, and I'd got to apprentice under a film composer and worked in that genre for a long time and did some films myself. I've done about a dozen films, Anyway, and the Orchestra Surreal that you mentioned earlier, a few years, it's been about 15 years now, I started it, and I wanted to have an outlet. The hardest part, I think, especially if you want to write music that's not mainstream or even anything, really, you have to have an outlet of some kind. I think that's the hardest thing, I think, for musicians to kind of accomplish is to have, and writers, anybody. I mean, if you want to get good at something, I don't care what it is, you got to do it all the time. You just got to get better at it. You just got to constantly be at it. If you want to write, you want to be good at writing, you need to do it. And it helps, at least for me, I need something to kind of kick me in the butt, and I need a deadline. And I'm a little ADD, and I tend to be a little all over the place. So for me to get focused, it helps to have something, a solid reason to write for. If it's just left on my own, I'll do half of 10 things instead of one of one thing, and so that was kind of my own way of coping. My own coping skills was to create my own orchestra that I had to, of course, write for and book concerts for, and also why I did it was I kind of noticed that a lot of film composers, I won't name names, but you know, there's a lot of plagiarism that goes on in film music, and I always kind of thought that what a great opportunity to steal from your favorite your composers and integrate it in a way that so you can learn. You know, it's an opportunity to learn, and so with the Orchestra Surreal, the idea behind it was I wanted to do something that was familiar with people, the music that was familiar but yet really different. So I mashed together, long before I ever knew what the term mashup was, I started mashing together classical music with rock and roll and you know stuff, songs I grew up playing, really. So I'd take like a Jimi Hendrix tune and mash it together with like Stravinsky and this kind of a thing. And that was kind of the whole concept behind the Orchestra Surreal. That's why it's very eclectic. I wanted to create an environment where I could write almost any kind of music, and it would fit in the context of that surreal environment. So it became a great chop builder, a great opportunity. And I, of course, over the years have had a lot of great musicians come and sit in with a band, as people like Keith Emerson and things have played with my orchestra. I kind of did it really more as a learning tool. As much as anything. Are you still there?
Yes, absolutely. I'm just so enthralled with the fact that you let your creativity kind of roll and all of the things that have come out of that, rather than doing something that is incredibly disciplined and structured, you're approaching it in a much more free-flowing, creative way. And out of that has come all of this amazing stuff,
Yeah, well, it's funny. When you say disciplined and free-flowing, I mean, I think in order to get anything done, there's a certain level of discipline that's necessary, I think for me, what I like to do, right now I'm working on a commission for an oratorio, and I get these commissions every 2 years or something, for like an orchestra piece for another orchestra, and of course – it's always the hardest thing, of course, is where do you begin, and how do you start something like that? And you talked about what got me thinking about this is just that whole free-flowing idea. And I think for me as a writer, as a composer, is that I try to start by not writing. I write by not writing. And in that, I just start noodling around and with things that and without the intention of going, I got to write something great. It's sort of when you're writing a story or something, what's going to be the first sentence? Like, don't get hung up on what the first sentence is or try not to be nonlinear about it, I guess is the best way to say it. Just throwing ideas out there. And what's kind of happened for me, now I've been doing this for a long time, is I get to kind of a certain point where I have enough material where almost like the subconscious mind kind of kicks in I start. It's this kind of constant back and forth between your logical, rational mind and your sort of your left brain, your right brain, your creative side. And so I try to get out of the way of the creative side and just be non-judgmental and just put things down and try to actually even feel what it means. What does that mean to me emotionally? I think especially with composers that are educated composers or the academic composers, their mind kind of gets in the way. And I think that can be a problem. If you start thinking about it too much, you can stifle your ideas your mind goes, well, that's not cool enough, or that's not clever enough, or that's too obvious. And sometimes those obvious is better. I always kind of admired, it's funny. I remember I have a friend, she wrote a novel, and it's about musicians and stuff. And she's a very good writer. She's a very, very talented person. Her name is Angela Kell Brown. But one of her books, I kind of objected to the ending. I go, why did you do this? I mean, it seemed like you were just setting up this kind of, it was kind of like the obvious ending. And she goes, well, that would have been too obvious, And I go, yeah, but that would have been good. It would have been really satisfying, And it made me think about Disney, One of the things that Disney doesn't have a problem with is, it's not afraid to be corny and not cool and not unhip. It's like, it's there's a weird freedom in like allowing yourself to just do what's expected. And there's something sometimes satisfying about that, because I think we get hung up on trying to be clever and cool and hip, and that is its own, I think, can be its own problem. And I mean, I notice this with composers, that especially like academic composers, they try so hard to not be predictable that their music is so non-predictable that it's meaningless. Because in order to be non-predictable or unpredictable, you have to set up something that has a certain level of predictability in order for it to be unpredictable. Does that make sense? Because you have to be able to give a sudden turn to the, you have to set up something that you're an expectation. If you create no expectations, then there's no surprise, right?
Yeah.
So, and that's true with a story. That's true with anything. And I think sometimes that can be a problem. And in a weird way, it takes a certain level of maturity to balance that element between predictability and being able to create those kind of surprises, you know?
Yeah.
You
know what really comes to mind for me, Ross, is, you know, after you've had a really successful TV series, and they do a finale, sometimes they just blow it completely out of the water from the standpoint of they lose the portrayal of the characters, they lose the regular storyline and trying to be spectacular, you know, and some of the ones that are maybe a little more predictable to me are more comfortable because that's why I've been watching the show for years, you know?
Well, every character, when I was writing my book, each character has a certain parameter in which it's logical, it's believable. What it's believable. What is that character capable of doing? And, you know, how far is it? You know, is he or she going to go, or what is he or she going to do? And if you start bouncing around way too far beyond that, then it becomes unbelievable and I think that you lose. Yeah, you lose something. You lose the reality of it. If even my book's sci-fi, you know, I mean, it's not really based on reality so much. But characters have to appear real, and they have to be consistent, and there has to be a thing in order for them to be relatable. You know, if you want to relate to them and have some kind of connection to them, and if you want to care about them, you know, I think that's part of, regardless of the environment they're in, whether it's a, you know, if they're cavemen or in the future, anywhere in between, you know, you still have to kind of, they have aspirations and they have goals and they have things that they need to do to survive. And if those things are not, if they're not operating within the parameters of what that character is capable of, then you don't care what happens to them.
Yeah. I totally get what you're saying. Absolutely. Which brings me to the point that you have really written an amazing book. It's already won an award, several awards, and we're going to be promoting your book to bestseller here very shortly. And it's not a small book. It's 500 pages of a wonderful story, Falling from Eden, Inc., The Chronicles of Ethan Stone. So tell me a little bit about how you came about writing a book, because you really seem very dedicated to the field of music. And so how did this come about for you?
Yeah, it's funny. There's that saying that everyone's got at least one novel in them. I had this idea a long, long time ago. And the funny thing is, I struggled really hard writing it, because I didn't. My background is not as a writer. I mean, I was a composer, and it's a similar discipline, you know. And as a composer, I do think kind of literarily, as the way I approach music, in that I believe each theme is like a character, and the environment the character's in, and there's a certain character development, meaning the way the theme morphs and grows. And, you know, I kind of, my sort of analysis of music is that way. So anyway, I had this idea. It's funny. The premise of the book came to me a long time ago when I was working on a cruise ship. and I had this idea of, I guess I was reading a lot too. The only, the, the most reading and the most sleeping I ever did in my life was when I worked on a cruise ship. As a musician, I worked at, and what happened was, you know, a cruise ship is its own little world. You know, you're stuck on a boat, and there's people from all over the world, different countries and different cultures and different languages and so forth, and they tend to be a bit segregated because, you know, they hire people, like, for example, the people from the Philippines are the guys who are do the maintenance, and the people who are from Europe do the, you know, the waitering and so forth, and all the Americans, the only Americans were the entertainment, you know? It's a kind of weird little scene. But anyway, but I was intrigued by this idea of that kind of that the structure of that environment, and well, and then the other thing was, what would happen if you lived in an environment where all of a sudden you lived where the gravity increased, like you lived where instead of gravity being what it is on Earth, it was like say 10 times that, you know? How would you adapt, right? And so that's sort of the basic premise behind my novel is the hero or the main character, Ethan Stone. He goes onto a space station and there's an accident, and in the space station being like the cruise ship, you know, there was this sort of environment only way more elaborate, and of course it's in space and not you know, a boat. And then all of a sudden he's living in a world of this hypergravity, and then he goes back to Earth, and that's the basic premise of it. And there was a lot of politics that emerged from that as well, which I was kind of and human observation and these kinds of things. That the reason I wanted to, I mean, I think it's really important for a book like this that it could very easily be a kind of a two-dimensional kind of almost comic book. So, you know, it really kind of addresses a lot more issues, and you know, to kind of give it some substance, you know. But that was the initial thing was the idea. And I tried to write it, and I didn't know what I was doing. And I, you know, I would get hung up on writing it first person or third person or this and that. And then I finally, this is kind of a funny, funny story actually, but I went to this, I bought a book. I actually went to a seminar once by one of those learning annex classes. And this guy was selling his book. His name was Alan, and it was Alan and Ellie DeEver. They wrote a book called How to Write a Book on Anything in 2 weeks or Less, Scripps 2. And it's funny, I had this book lying around, and finally I decided to read it after struggling. And that book really was kind of, for me, was the missing link. I needed something to give me how to structure a book, you know, how to lay out the chapters, how to blueprint it, how to set it up so I had a structure that I could fill in. And I remember, because I didn't know where how it was going to end, the plot was really baffling me a lot, you know. And I remember laying it. It took me probably almost a year to, like, blueprint the whole book, you know. And once I had that, I remember I had all these chapters laid out with all the, you know, what's each chapter going to be about and all this kind of thing. And I remember looking at that going, well, all right, if I can just fill this in, I will have a book that makes sense, and it'll be done, you know. And that was, you know, that was sort of my college classes. That was sort of my version of how to, you know, taking writing workshops or something. And also, while I was doing this, while I was writing the book, I hooked up with some guys who were all writers, and we would get together once a week or once every other week. And you know, as to kind of keep each other, you know, motivated to write their novels. And out of all of the guys that did it, three of us actually finished books and have them published. So it kind of worked out.
That is fantastic. So how long did it take you to write this? Because this is really a massive undertaking.
Yeah, well, I would say, here's the thing. After I read the book, How to Write a Book, after I read How to Write a Book in 2 weeks or Less, it took me about 2 years to get my first draft. So well, I actually had something that looked like a book. And then after that, it was about another year and a half of edits and rewrites. And, you know, when I had some other people kind of go in and do some edit, the story never really changed. You know, I have some, I can tell you my writing skills. I had one of my neighbors actually, she's a retired college professor and a grammar nerd. I mean, she's like, call her the grammar Nazi, you know, I mean, but I asked her if she would, like, you know, just kind of proofread my book. And after about three or four chapters, she comes up and goes, she basically just says, she sat me down and said, this is what you're doing. You're constantly doing these things wrong. And here they are, blah, blah, blah. And so she kind of gave it, which was actually great that she did that, because then I went back and looked at it. And you know how, like anything, once you kind of gain a certain level of awareness, suddenly then you become more conscious of all kinds of things. And all of a sudden I was reading this stuff going, oh, my God. And I, you know, went and fixed all these. It was mostly a lot of tenses and just like academic stuff, you know, stuff I should have learned in school kind of things, you know. I mean, because I think the creative part, I mean, one of the things is what I, for me, as I write this thing, it's very visual. It's very visual for me. And it's sort of, I just seen this, you know, whatever the scene is, go down. And I'm just sort of like almost transcribing it as I'm, my mind is sort of playing this little movie in my head, you know. Because a lot of people have read the book and said, oh, this make a great film. You know, in a weird way, well, that's kind of what it was originally in my
for
mind,
you,
you know.
Yeah,
exactly. Anyway, and so yeah, there was a certain, so my level, this is like, I remember when I wrote my first symphony, I really learned a lot about what it means to write a symphony, you know, I mean, because it's one thing to sort of analyze them and to study them, it's another thing to do it. And it's the same with a book. I mean, we've all read books and we all know what a good book has in it. And you can sort of say, you know, you can talk about it from the after the fact, but once you actually sit down and do it, that changes the game in your mind. That's a whole different thing, you know. And for me, this book really made me very, very aware of what novels are capable of, and what, you know, what makes a book hold together well, and you know, it's a great learning experience, and nothing else, you know.
Yeah. Well, it certainly turned out to be a fantastic work. So tell me, how did you keep yourself from being discouraged or just like giving up over 3.5 years? That's a long time for a project, you know?
Yeah, it's funny. That's actually, I would say most of my music projects, I think that's longer than it's taken me to write my first symphony. And I've written a bunch of concertos and stuff, and no, this book is by far the longest undertaking I probably have. There's a certain stubbornness. I think really what helped a lot for me was by having the blueprint, by having knowing what the beginning, middle, and end of this story was before I started. I mean, laying that all out, kind of having a process, understanding that there's a process to anything. And that if you just hang in there and you stick with the process, you will get it done. And it may take, you know, and it doesn't matter if it takes you 5 years or 2 years or 2 weeks or 10, you know, as long as you get it done, you get it done. And trusting that it's there, because like I said, once I had the blueprint, I saw where I was going. It's just a matter of filling it in. It's like painting a house, you know. You got your bucket and your paintbrush and you're looking at this gigantic house and you go, all right, well, you know, if it's either you're either going to do it or you're not going to do it, you know, and it's not like a mystery anymore as to if, whether or not it can get done or whether or not it's going to turn out okay, you know. And I think that's where a lot of writers, if you don't know where you're going, it can be very, very challenging, because that's, I mean, when I first started writing before I read the book, I started writing all these chapters, and I got to about 15 chapters in it, and all of a sudden I realized I'm going off on these tangents, and I'm thinking, I'm giving this character way too much time, and this isn't making sense, and that was very frustrating, and that was, like, I would put it down for a while, and it really was that having the, like, it's like anything, there's a trick, there's a method, there's a methodology to anything, and as long as you if you have that, if you understand what it is you're doing, it certainly makes it a lot easier. And I think that's probably my, and I'm a fairly stubborn person as well, you know, so that, you know, that helps.
Yeah. And passion too. When you have passion for what you're doing, you're not as inclined to want to let it go. I'm just curious, what you're doing so much and you've got so much left to do in this world. What would you like to see if you were to look at the work that you're doing both in music and in writing books? What would you like to leave as your legacy or your contribution to the world? How would you like to impact the world with your art?
Wow, that's a big question. You know, that's I don't know. I mean, I like to think that, you know, there, I got people to think about something. I think, you know, in the novel, I was telling you how, you know, there's a certain, I've always been a fan of things that have lots of layers to them, you know. I remember, for a fun example, like Rocky and Bullwinkle, for example. You know, if you ever watch those old cartoons, there's a certain level, like when I was a little kid, I just saw a squirrel and a moose, you know, and then they were just going around doing these dumb little things. It wasn't until I got to be an adult where I was actually getting the jokes, you know. I mean, there's a lot more levels to those dumb little cartoons than you thought of when you realize when you were a kid, you know. And so I wanted this book to have that, you know. There's a lot of, you know, there's a whole lot of, you know, I kind of strongly kind of, I shouldn't say, what right word, you know, I kind of bash corporate America a little bit, you know, and it's in this book, and that's not like really the main topic of the book. If you were just to have a book about bashing corporate America, that wouldn't, you know, and how corrupt and, you know, and psychotic it is, really. I mean, that wouldn't go over very well. It wouldn't really, what would be the point? But in the context of the story, I try to, like, point that out, you know, in, by the way the characters operate and so forth. And so I like to, you know, see that, like, maybe that you can, you know, educate people a little bit to a viewpoint, you know. And I think as a musician, one of the things I always like is that I always had this sort of idea that I never liked the idea of musical boundaries, genres, you know. Some, you know, this music does this and this music does that. And so my whole idea of the orchestra surreal being real eclectic is that, you know, that all these, it's just sound, it's just music, and it all can come together. And I always used to have this thing, it's a little bit corny, and I kind of quit using it. But the idea being that by mixing all these genres together, you know, if and these genres kind of represent an ideology or almost a certain slice of our humanity, if all these genres can coexist, and so therefore so all people can coexist, you know, that there's the that there's a certain commonality that we all have. And, you know, I like to see that there's a certain egalitarian sort of approach to my work, and that hopefully that translates a little bit. And, you know, unifying people and ideas as opposed to segregating them, you know?
Oh, I love that. I love that. That is so powerful. Thank you for sharing that. That's really, that's wonderful that is really what, you know, has made you do some of these wonderful things that you've done, create in the way that you have. So time has just flown by with you, Ross. Do you have any closing ideas for our writers and authors?
Well, I mean, just like I, not really. I mean, just whatever it is you're doing, just hang in there and do it, you know. And like I said, there's lots of things. There's the sort of the overview of the big picture of, you know, hang in there, do it, be yourself, be honest, don't be afraid to, you know, say whatever it is you want to say, that kind of stuff. And then there's a technical side, which is like really get your beginning, middle, and end sorted out. What it is you really want the book to do and mean and say, and I would highly recommend blueprinting, you know. And I wish the drag is, I really think this for me, that book, How to Write a Book in 2 Weeks or Less, is impossible to find now. Unfortunately, it's just doesn't exist. I mean, I saw it on Amazon or something. They wanted $10,000 for it. I mean, I think it was a joke, you know. Like, it's funny. It's just it's not even like a real book. It's just an 8.5 by 11 kind of pamphlet that this guy put together, and he's impossible to find. They were both kind of a strange couple, you know. Anyway, I mean, but very brilliant. He's kind of a brilliant guy, you know. Anyhow, so for other authors, you know, I mean, my always thing is, God, if I can do it, anybody can do it. So just hang in there and believe in yourself you know, and don't be afraid to expose yourself, because that's ultimately I think we all admire about artists, is that they're fearless in their ability to expose. I had this, I'm not going to go off on a tangent, but I always had this sort of concept of what's the difference between an artist and a craftsman. And I think that an artist uses its medium to expose who it is they are in a way that you can't explain through words. That part of our humanity, they're willing to expose that side of themselves. Where a craftsman uses the same medium, but doesn't do that. He may even have better craft than the artist, but they're not exposing that side of themselves. In fact, oftentimes they're hiding themselves by their craft, you know. And I think sometimes that's the difference. Because I often wondered, why is there good art and bad craft, and bad craft and good art, you know? And so that's sort of my take on that, you know. So not being afraid to expose yourself, and that's, you know, not an easy thing to do.
Wow, that is again so powerful. Gosh, Ross, thank you so much for sharing all of this great information and really what sparks your creativity. It's just been fabulous time with you. I was wondering, do you have a website or some place where people can go to connect if they would like to do so?
Yeah, sure. It's Ross, then -write.com is one. That's my just my personal website. It has a lot of concert music. It has my book on there. And then I also have one for the Orchestra Surreal, and that's the Orchestra Surreal. And orchestra is spelled a little weird. It's spelled with an E, O-R-C-H-E-S-T-R-E, like Orchestra Surreal, S-U-R-R-E-A-L.com. And that has, you know, our Orchestra Surreal stuff on it, you know, video and things. And you can see, I have a pseudonym. My Orchestra Surreal name is Elvis Schoenberg, which for those who don't get it's kind of a nerdy musician's nerd joke. If you don't know who Arnold Schoenberg is, he was a, you know, sort of the poster child, or he was the innovator of a 12-tone serialism, very like an avant-garde 20th century composer, you know, very kind of the grandfather of that whole style. And then, of course, Elvis being Elvis. So they're about as opposite of musical entities as you can have. And that's kind of what the Orchestra Surreal is all about, you know, having these extreme opposites and everything in between come together, you know.
Oh, I love it. I just love that concept. Ross, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Well, thank you for including me.
And for anyone who would like to learn more about Expert Insights, our best-selling books, award-winning magazines, and global broadcasting communities, you can find us at getei.com. That's getei.com. And everyone have a wonderful week. Until next time.